So today I would like to continue the journey which we started yesterday. So yesterday we started discussing systems with continuous symmetry. And so in particular we have chosen to describe a simple model which is n vector model. And so again you have, let's say, the cubic lattice of spins. But now each spin, so this is position I, let's say, and this is my spin. So the lattice is d-dimensional. So in the n-vector model, so we have two things. So we have d dimensions, is the dimension of the lattice, and then we describe each spin by a vector Si, and so there'll be another one Sj. And so n-vector model means that this vector is n-dimensional. So Si is an n-vector. And so the corresponding Hamiltonian was just minus 1/2, again, sum over I and j, jij, now Si, and scalar product with Sj. And so staring at this Hamiltonian, you realize that there is a rotational symmetry. So if I rotate all the spins by arbitrary rotation, then the Hamiltonian doesn't change. So this thing has On continuous symmetry. Okay. And so whereas this doesn't matter in high, sufficiently high dimensions, this will have crucial, you know, impact when the dimension is approaching dimension number 2. So then we had, we could construct a Landau-Ginzburg functional for this theory. And so writing the fields as Fi, which is the magnitude times the direction, so n is a unit vector, and this guy is the magnitude. And so of course A goes 1 to n, which is the number of fields which we have. Can you still see here? Okay, it's perfect. And so this n, it's just equal to 1. It's just a unit vector showing me the direction of these fields. Then the Landau-Ginzburg functional, and so we had two expressions for that, but the one which was using rho and n is just integral ddx, and then it's 1/2 napla rho square plus 1/2 rho square napla na. Napla na, and then plus r over 2 rho square plus u over 4 rho to the 4. Okay, so that was our Landau-Ginzburg functional. And so we did the mean field theory analysis. And so in the mean field theory analysis, I will try to draw this picture again. Okay, let me try. So we found that the field, so this is my free energy, if you want, and these are my fields, so phi 1 and phi 2. And so there is a maximum in the origin, and then it goes down, and then it goes down, and something like that. And so the radius of the circle, of this radius 0 in the mean field theory approximation, and of course our direction n is going outside of that thing here. And so we, so that was the mean field theory approximation, so we realized that we can have any n, so all these n's are equally realized, but this rho 0, the value of the rho 0 was predicted by the mean field theory, and it depends on this r and u coupling constants. Okay, and then we studied the fluctuations, and basically you can study the fluctuations in the n direction, so basically going up and down here, so that's what we call delta phi 1 fluctuations, and then you can study the fluctuations, you know, along the minimum, which is this one, which we call delta phi perpendicular. And so whereas the delta phi 1 fluctuations, they behave as you would expect. They are massive fluctuations. You have to climb the potential, so you come back and so on. So everything is as we know it. These delta phi perpendicular actually are massless things, and so they are Goldstone modes. So this for this along this minimum, and so what I try to show you is that these things actually fluctuate like crazy as you approach two dimensions, as d goes to 2. Okay, and so this was the origin of this theorem, saying, well, these fluctuations as you approach two dimensions are so big that you cannot have a long Grange order at finite temperature for the systems with continuous symmetry. And there's this beautiful theorem saying that. Okay, so what I would like to do today is really to concentrate on this d equal to 2. And you know, there's some very interesting physics going on. So today you look at near d equal to 2 dimensions. And so what we realize from this picture is that these fluctuations along the minimum are really, really much more important as you approach 2 dimensions than those fluctuations up and down here. So fluctuations of NA are very important, whereas for rho, you can just take rho 0, which is the mean field theory prediction. Okay, so if this is true, and we are really close to 2 dimensions, we can simplify this Landau-Ginzburg functional significantly. Namely, we can take rho to be approximately equal to rho 0. And so this thing, which is something, you know, given by coupling constants. So this is just a constant. This is just a constant. Of course, that rho doesn't fluctuate too much. So this is 0. And so the only term which actually survives is this term here. Okay, so then you get a simplified functional, which is just n, and then rho 0 square over 2, and then d dx, and then nabla and a, nabla and a. d2x. Well, let's keep d at this point then. Okay, so this is close to d equal to 2 dimensions. That functional just simplifies into this thing here. So this looks very simple. So if n were a field, so this would be just, you know, free scalar fields, and so you know that they would be Gaussian theory, and everything would be simple. But the problem is that these fields actually are normalized. So n is a unit vector. And so there is an additional constraint which you have to take into account, so that this is actually not a field theory, not a free field theory. So not Gaussian, not free Gaussian theory. As we have the constraint, which is that m is just equal to 1. And so this constraint actually makes it very, very complicated theory. And to stress that it's nonlinear, although it looks linear, this is called nonlinear sigma model.
Wouldn't it be easier in this case to separate phi in real life imaginary part?
We shall do that in 2 dimensions, basically. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so in dimensions higher than 2, you have these massless bosons, like these massless modes, right?
Yeah.
Which means that the system will spontaneously rotate. And move around.
Yeah, sure.
And in low dimensions, that doesn't happen. Is there any intuition why that wouldn't happen in 2D?
No, it happens in 2D.
Because there's...
Yeah, it happens in 2D. So basically, the fluctuations around, you know, of this direction are bigger and bigger as you approach d equal to 2 from above. Yeah. So you know, we calculated the
Okay, but if it moves around freely, you can never do mean field theory, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So
freely.
You cannot do mean field theory. So that's why you know that mean field theory picture completely breaks down, and you have crazy fluctuations, and
if
you cannot do expansion around mean.
In low dimensions. So it's the other way around. What I said.
Sorry.
So it's just the other way around. What I said. At high dimensions, you can still do mean field theory.
That's right.
But how can you ever do mean field theory if there's massless modes? It can just move around.
Well, we have seen that the integral converges, so there are some fluctuations, but in some sense they are not that important. You can still have these things, but these fluctuations
like having
can be
a
small.
Potential and saying if I push my particle, it will come back. It's a very odd thing to say, no? I mean, on the circle.
Well, naively, yes.
Is flat. It can just rotate freely, and nothing happens.
Well, I like your physical
small.
Intuition, but we had the mass yesterday, and so the mass showed you that yes, you have finite fluctuations.
But why?
Okay.
There's some mechanism working against it, no? Never
mind. I don't know if somebody has a better answer on this question. So what people usually do is that they say, well. This thing has to be proportional to 1 over t, because you have s is minus beta h, or beta h, so beta is 1 over t. So you can always arrange units that sometimes people just put it like 1 over 2t, and then whatever that there is, ddx and nabla na, nabla na. And I'll just use this notation, so basically training this rho 0 to 1 over 2t. Okay, so t is hiding in rho 0 square. Okay, so now you can study the Archy flow equation. So you can do the normalization procedure for this. But instead of doing the expansion around 4 dimensions, around the mean field theory, you'll be doing the expansion around 2 dimensions. Okay, so now set up t equals to 2 plus epsilon expansion. So I remind you, this is the lower critical dimension. So we are basically doing the expansion on this lower critical dimension. And so you can show, although it's much more painful than for the Ising model, that if you introduce a so you have now only one coupling here, which is this coupling T, right? The temperature is your coupling now. So now you get the RG equations for this T, but I'll just rescale it by the cutoff. So I'll have dT over dL is, so now this term you can guess, and then you have the first correction, which depends on the number of fields you have. And then there's this constant kd and t tilde square. So this is your RG equation, where this t tilde is just lambda to power epsilon times t. So basically, and this kd is just sd over 2 pi to power d. So some constant, which is positive. Okay, so these are our RG equations, and then you can analyze these equations, and so you, obviously you see, because it's a quadratic thing here, you will have two solutions, so you have two fixed points. Two fixed points. So one of them is T star equals to 0, which is, well, stable one. And then you have another one, which is, if I'm solving this quadratic equation, it's proportional to epsilon divided by n minus 2 divided by kd. So it's epsilon n minus 2, and then kd. Okay, so these are your two fixed points. And if you plot your RG flow, so now you have only this one thing here. So this is your t tilde. And so one fixed point is here at 0. And another fixed point is, you know, very, very close to 0 because epsilon is small. And so this is the critical point. And then by analyzing the vicinity of these two critical points, you can show that the flow goes this way. So I have really a critical point here. Below temperatures, for temperatures smaller than that, I flow to ferromagnetic phase. And above, I have the paramagnetic phase. So here, I flow that direction here. Okay. So this is what happens if you are slightly above two dimensions. But if you are exactly at two dimensions, then epsilon is equal to 0. And so because this critical point is proportional to epsilon, so the value of that critical point is proportional to epsilon. So if I set epsilon to 0, and this actually guy merges with 0, and I lose this phase transition whatsoever. OK, so let me continue here. Yeah?
So if you're in two dimensions and also n equals 2, it seems that so t is always going to be fixed.
So you are saying you are in two dimensions and n equal to 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll discuss that in a minute. So wait, is that question? It's actually a very interesting case. Okay, so exactly for d equal to 2, well, the first term vanishes, so your flow is just t tilde over dl. It's just n minus 2, and then kd and t tilde square. And so you have always the flow like that, and there is your 0. There is your t tilde. So you have only disordered phase. So we have lack of order. Which is as it must, because you have the theorem saying that in two dimensions you cannot have that. You cannot have long-range order in two dimensions. And so this is a particular example of that fact.
You still have the ordered phase that...
So you have only the paramagnetic phase. So this is only the paramagnetic phase. So epsilon, you know, so here I would have the ferromagnetic region if you want. Here I have the paramagnetic one. If I send epsilon to 0, I basically kill the ferromagnetic region. Okay. So now, just as an aside, for those who have seen Yang-Mills theory beta function, so this is basically a beta function for four dimensions. So Yang-Mills in 4D has the same beta function. And so this is some interesting consequences. So one consequence which you know about Yang-Mills in 4D is that there may be something which is called asymptotic freedom. And so basically, your quarks have to be confined together. And so if you try to separate them, the force in between them actually increases. So you cannot have free quarks, basically. And so the same thing happens here. So basically, if you think about the correlation length, so the correlation length basically goes to 0 no matter where you start. And so in light scale, the correlation length will be 0. If you think about the correlation length as the distance between the quarks, then the distance between the quarks has to go to 0. Okay, so this is just a hint, but there's a, you know, deep connection between basically spin chains and then, you know, the spin theory is in two dimensions, and the Young-Mills theory in four dimensions. And so this will be a subject of string theory exploration course. So you will, basically the whole course will be, you know, the integrability of Young-Mills theory, and you know, people will be mapping that to 2D spin chains and so on. So this is, you know, wait for string theory exploration course if you are interested in this string theory explorations. I hope this year as well. Okay, so this is what happens, d equal to 2, but n not equal to 2. So now returning back to your question. So what happens when both of these things actually are equal to 2? And that's a very, very special case. So very special case, special and interesting case, is when you have two fields, but you are also in two dimensions. Okay? So then, if you look at this beta function, of course, this beta function was calculated, you know, to some approximation, let's say second order approximation. But to that second order, this is 0, and that guy is 0. So to the second order, your beta function vanishes. So now you can actually show that if this is the case, then the beta function vanishes identically, no matter to which order. Beta function is 0 to all orders. So, you know, something interesting really, really happens here. So now if you are in two dimensions, I will do some transformation using really the fact that we are in two dimensions. So basically whatever you wanted there, I want to split into like real and imaginary part, but yeah. So basically cosine and sine. Okay? So you can parameterize your n vector now as a cosine theta. So introduce an angle theta, and this is in my x direction, and then sine theta in my y direction. So this is my parametrization of the vector n in two dimensions. And this theta, of course, have to belong to 0 to 2 pi because it's just an angle here. So why I have done that parametrization? Because then automatically your n will be a unit vector. Right? So if you do this, then you automatically know that, so from here it follows that n is equal to 1. Moreover, if you're interested how this nonlinear sigma model now looks like, all you have to do is to calculate nabla on n. Okay, so nabla on n, well, these are just unit vectors, so nabla doesn't do anything to them, and this is it just differentiate the theta angle. So differentiating cosine, I get minus sine nabla theta x, and differentiating sine, I get cosine, so plus cosine theta nabla theta y. And so then I want to do nabla na dot nabla na. So nabla n dot nabla n. Well, of course, if I dot x and y, I get 0 because they are perpendicular. So basically, I get this thing times x square, which is 1. So I get sine square theta nabla theta square from the first term, and then plus cosine square theta nabla theta square, which is nothing else than nabla theta square. Nabla theta square. So your nonlinear sigma model now has very, very simple form. S of theta is equal to 1 over 2t d2x and nabla theta square. So we are exactly in two dimensions. And yeah. So now we solve the constraint. And so again, this looks like a free theory, right? So again, you have basically nabla on phi square. But there is still a catch. So still, we didn't manage to actually linearize our nonlinear sigma model by solving the constraint. And the catch is that this theta is not really a real variable which goes from 0 to infinity, but rather this theta is still compactified. It's an angle which has to go from 0 to 2 pi. So we haven't still, turned it into a linear nice theory. It's still something ugly hiding there, because this theta is compactified and it belongs to 0 to 2 pi. Okay. So let's forget about it first. Okay. So let's say that. So let's pretend that theta is like normal real variable, which is not compactified, Okay, if this were the case, then there is some, calculation which should take some time, but I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to give you the result. Then you can calculate what is the correlation function between n and n prime. So n at x and n at x prime. So, of course, n is something like cosine and sine of these. So if I take n, if I take a correlation function g to be a correlation function of e to ix, I theta x, and e to minus I theta, let's say 0, this will be my g of x. Okay, so basically what you want is a correlation function between n and n, but you can write it as exponential of theta. Okay, and so you can calculate this by just, pretending this theta is like normal variable, there is no compactification whatsoever. Then you get the Gaussian integrals and stuff like that. And so I omit all the steps because they are not very interesting. Well, from mathematical point of view, they are, but from physics point of view, not really. So what you find out is that you actually have to introduce the cutoff, lattice spacing, so that your integrals converge. And so again, I will set the cutoff lambda to equal to 1 over a, the lattice spacing. Okay, so what you get if you do that is that you find that this correlation function is given by t over 2 pi. Okay, so you just have to believe me here. For those who don't, they can do the calculation themselves. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question. The lecture notes say that if you now write down the action, that you have like exactly massless time Gordon, except that theta is compact.
Yeah.
And so you say this is not Gaussian theory.
Yeah.
Why can't I study a massless compactified boson?
Well, you can. Yeah.
Cylinder.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
And in 2D, that's like a very nice theory that everyone knows everything about. No.
Okay. Well, sure.
But not.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure. You can do that. Yes. So basically, you can probably study this by a method of images and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's possible to do it. So, but here I am first doing, let's theta is not compactified, and then you find that gx has this following form. Of course, now you want to compare this to the form which you would like to have, which is e to x minus xi, and then x to d minus 2 plus eta. Okay, so this is how your correlation function should look like. And so we immediately see that this term is not here. In other words, the correlation length is actually infinite. So xi goes to infinity. And so if you are in two dimensions, d is equal to 2. So this is just x to eta. So eta is just t over 2 pi. Okay. So now, if something strange is really happening, taking into account that our beta function dt over dl is equal to zero, so of course the beta function is always equal to zero, so that's our RG flow equation, which we still have here. So that means that any temperature is basically a fixed point of this thing here. So now you see that for any temperature, I can calculate the critical exponents, which depend on this temperature. And you know, under Xi, actually, the correlation length diverges. So it really seems like for every temperature, I have a fixed point where the correlation length diverges, and where I can calculate some critical exponents, which depend on what this temperature is. Okay, so it seems like a line of fixed points. Where you know the Xi diverges or like fixed points or critical points. However, of course, this cannot be true. I cannot have phase transition at every temperature, and the reason is that there is no long range order at this point, but there is no long range order. So what would mean that I have long range order is that if I take just one of these guys and take an average, it will go to some constant magnetization. So for in order to have long range order, you would have to have something like equal to m, which would be non-trivial m, and would be magnetization. Okay? So this would have to happen if I had a long-range order. But you can check that, well, that this thing actually is not true, and then you get always zero. Okay? So that's not true. You always get identically equal to zero. So there is no long-range order here whatsoever. Okay? So we have something strange is happening in this, in this line of critical points. But it's definitely not a long range order. Okay.
And what is it?
Okay, I'll tell you. Just a second. So this is true for any temperature. Right? So it seems that I can take any temperature, and this this calculation shows for that temperature I find this critical exponent. I find that Xi diverges, and so that would mean that at any temperature you really have a correlation length which is infinite. Okay? That cannot be right. If you go back to your microscopic model, well, after all, it's just, it looks like Ising model. It's J times sigma I, sigma J. Okay? And so, of course, if you have, so it's basically interactions of things. And so if you have sufficiently high temperatures, of course, these interactions of spins, there will be so big fluctuations because of the temperature that these spins cannot actually, be correlated on large distances. Okay? So physically, for large temperatures, Xi cannot diverge. The correlation length must be finite. So really, if you have sufficiently large temperatures, they must, the spins won't be all ordered in the same way, right? So Xi must be finite. So there must exist actually some critical temperature. There exists a critical temperature. maybe it's not one temperature, maybe there's like radial phase transition, what happens. But anyway, temperature Tc, so that if you are T is smaller than Tc, then whatever we calculated here is correct. So your gx behaves like behaves like 1 over x to eta, and xi is infinite. So the calculation for small temperatures, what we have done here, is probably correct.
Haven't we found that the critical temperature is 0?
Huh?
Haven't we just found that this is 0?
I'll just write it down and return to your question. And for t bigger than t critical, your gx has the appropriate form. So it has some finite psi, and then gx behaves in this way. Okay, so to your question, so what I showed you, so of course you would expect that if you had long-range order, then the t-critical would have to be 0. That's the theorem and everything, right? But what I'm saying here is I don't have long-range order. I have something else. I have something else.
Well, the reason that there is no long-range order is that Tc, the critical temperature, is 0, isn't it?
That's right, yes. So there will be some kind of phase transition where actually, you know, the correlation length changes from finite to infinite, and correspondingly the correlation function changes its character. But this phase transition is not characterized by a long range order. Okay, so that's what I'm trying to say here. So this phase transition has nothing to do. With long-range order. Okay, so
what does it have to do with?
I'll tell you. wait. So what we really neglected is that this theta is an angle, and it, you know, goes from 0 to 2 pi, so it's compactified.
But I really do not understand. You have found 2 lectures ago that there is no phase transition in
No. What I showed you, or what I was trying to demonstrate, or at least motivate, is that yes, you cannot have long-range order. That your t critical is actually exactly equal to 0 in 2 dimensions regarding the long-range order. Okay, but you can have a different type of phase transition. Let me just explain what it is. So what actually really happened is that by assuming that theta, you know, is like a normal variable, is non-compact, you have neglected a very interesting possibility. And that is, we have neglected a possibility of something interesting happening. And that's basically, you can think about it like some kind of order, but not really. And so the possibility of vortices, of vortex-like configurations. Vortex-like configurations. So what is a vortex-like configuration? Nick already knows everything, so. Okay, so a vortex is, so if I, you know, this is my two-dimensional lattice, and so I can have a point in the lattice, basically, and around the point, the spins just, you know, twist around. So this is my n here, and then there will be an n as I go around this point, and then an N here, and then D here, and here. So this is the vortex thing here. Is
this one lattice point or?
I have a point in the lattice,
yeah.
And the spins around it, they just, you know, twist around. They just twist around so that they form like this porcupine.
But you have one spin on each lattice point.
Ah, very good. So here, however, that's very good, very good. So here, what I have done when I discussed the Landau-Ginzburg functionals and so on, mm-hmm. I have taken the continuum limit,
oh,
right? So everything here is in the continuum limit. And you're absolutely right. This will break down. The continuum limit cannot be used to describe vortices, at least not close to this origin here. So the middle of the vortex is called vortex core. Okay, and so as we shall see, near the vortex core, we cannot use the continuum limit. We have to think about lattice, back about the lattice here. Okay, so now what is the characterization of the vortex? So obviously it looks like charge. So I should be able to discover the presence of this vortex by a Gauss theorem. So I surround this thing by some enclosed circle, and then I calculate a flux of all these things coming out. And if it's non-trivial, I get a non-trivial charge associated with the vortex. So in other words, if I take this as a closed circle, which I can place anywhere in the same way as you can do it for the Gauss theorem for normal charge, you can calculate a finite R or 2R or 3R, doesn't matter. And then you calculate nabla theta times dl, then if you have some vortex present, it gives you 2 pi n, where n is called winding number. If it's equal to 1, that means that your spins, actually, as you go around, they just twist about 2 pi. If it's equal to minus 1, they go the other way around, in some sense. Okay, so and it tells you, basically, how much these spins go around the CSS. Yeah. So now notice, of course, that you really notice the presence of the vortex from very, very far away. Okay? So really, I can calculate this integral anywhere I want, as long as I, as long as my vortex core is inside that thing. So I can really notice the presence of vortex very, very far away. So what it means is that all the spins around the vortex, no matter how far away, they have to twist around in the prescribed direction. So putting a vortex into your condensed matter system or whatever actually costs lots of energy because you have to twist all the spins in the whole condensed matter system. It's not just you twisting the spins near the origin, but I have to twist all of them. Okay, so this is, vortex can be detected. Vortex can be detected from very, very far away. And in fact, because you have to basically twist all the spins you have in the system, putting a vortex in the system costs infinite energy. Okay, so costs infinite energy.
In the continuum limit.
And so far I'm discussing everything in the continuum limit. Costs infinite energy because I have to twist all the spins and
Are vortices special for two dimensions?
No. So you can have, for example, cosmic string is an example of a vortex, if you want, in higher dimensions, in three dimensions. You have a string now, and so what it does, it cuts again, so you have some topological defect here, again, around the string. It cuts part of the space-time, if you want. So yes, you can have, so this is an example of a topological defect. meaning in some sense it's very difficult to create it because it costs infinite infinite energy. And so you can have topological defects in higher dimensions as well, but actually they are not so interesting for phase transitions, because in higher dimensions you have normal phase transitions. You have like really you can have t-critical and you can have long-range order, and that costs much less energy than this thing. So the vortices play role for phase transitions only in two dimensions, because in a higher dimension you can still have them, but they are not energetically favorable if you want. So in higher dimension this is the long-range order which governs whether you have phase transition or not.
They can exist.
They can exist. Yes. Yeah.
Why would they not be interesting if they can exist in higher order? They're just very rare, or.
Well, okay, so nobody observed cosmic strings so far, although they could have been created. Yeah. So, but in principle, they exist. Yeah. They can exist.
Okay, but you say that they're not that interesting. I think if someone would detect a cosmic string, that would be a pretty big thing. Right?
Okay, that would be interesting. In that sense, yeah. I was saying they are not interesting for phase transitions, because you have long-range order in higher dimensions.
So.
Oh, that was my statement. Okay. So now to your thing. So now you can calculate. So look at this thing here. So if I am actually going closer and closer to the vortex core, of course my total L, if you want, is getting smaller and smaller. So this thing will be smaller and smaller. So this thing must become bigger and bigger. In fact, what you can show is that we will show that in a minute. Its nabla theta goes like 1 over r. Okay, so if you are actually going to the vortex core, let's say situated at r equal to 0, then this nabla theta goes huge. Okay, so nabla theta actually, you know, goes to infinity as r goes to 0. And of course, that tells you that, yeah, indeed, the continuum limit breaks down close to the vortex core. So continuum limit. Continuum limit breaks down near vortex core. Okay. And so as you correctly pointed out, so you have to basically replace that picture by something which lives on the lattice. So now this is my lattice. And let's say I have situated vortex in this placket. So my vortex sits there. And so let's say I want a vortex which really changes only by 2 pi. Then what really happens is that I have the nearby spin is this one here, that one here, that one here, and that one here. And this is as close I can get to the vortex. I cannot get closer because I have to live on the lattice. Okay? And so now if you look at what is the gradient of these angles, so this angle, well, this has theta that direction, and that has theta that direction. So the maximum is basically something like pi half. So theta I minus theta j goes maybe something like pi half. And so it's definitely not infinite. And because I have now finite lattice spin basing. So you can deal with this problem that your theta diverges close to the origin by returning back to the lattice system. And then, you know, everything is regularized and I don't have any divergences in nabla theta. Okay, and so you can read some paragraph in my lecture notes how this limit is actually done. So you can really start with the microscopic model. Now, with the ON model, now take n equal to 2, d equal to 2, and then you can basically arrive at this thing very, very easily in 2 steps, but only when this nabla theta is small. So only when, you know, the continuum limit is applicable, this nabla theta must be small, and so you do some expansion, Taylor expansion in that thing, and you get this functional here. Okay, so yes, the continuum limit breaks down, but it breaks down only in the vicinity of the core of the vortex. Okay, so why these objects can exist if they cost infinite energy? And so let me do this very simple calculation, which for some reason gives the right answer. So the question is, so why can we have vortices? Can we have vortices at all? And so for that, let me first calculate how much energy it really costs to create a vortex. And so as I said before, it's probably something like infinity. But it doesn't prevent us to have them. Okay, so let's calculate E for a single vortex. Single vortex. And so what you want to do is, so this is your Hamiltonian. So I just deleted it, but it's... So this is your Hamiltonian. And you want to minimize this Hamiltonian. So want to minimize this. Subject to the constraint that we have a vortex. So subject to the fact that you know this thing is true. Subject to that equation. Let's see, number of theta dot dl is 2 pi n, okay? So I have two equations to solve. And so you want to find what is the minimum energy, you know, to create the vortex, and the vortex imposes this restriction here. Okay. So for that, let me just first minimize this delta H. So I'm saying, well, Nick will not like that, but I'm doing delta H. So what is it equal to? So it's 1/2 d square x, then I have 2 nabla theta, delta theta and nabla theta. Okay, just differentiating this thing here. So 1/2 cancels this 2. And then I integrate by parts, shifting the derivative from this guy all the way up to here. So what you get is a minus, throwing away the boundary term, d square x, and then nabla square theta times delta theta. So if this is a minimum, it must be equal to 0. So you are getting that basically the theta must satisfy the Laplace equation, nabla square theta equals to 0. But at the same time, so you have lots of solutions of that, but at the same time, this must be true. Okay, so at the same time, that equation is true. And the solution that both these equations are true is that your theta is equal to n times phi, where phi is just a polar angle. So now I can describe the solution in polar coordinates, r and phi. And so you can find the solution that the theta is just a multiple of this phi. So if you have just vortex with this winding number 1, its theta is just phi. Okay, so it means that as I move along my vortex, the theta shifts exactly the same way as my phi angle, which parametrizes this thing here. Okay? So just to prove that the second equation is satisfied, so if I claim that nabla theta, well, theta is that thing, then you can show that nabla theta, do it yourself, is just n times unit vector along the direction of phi, and r, which is precisely this assertion here. So nabla theta goes like 1 over r. Okay, so it really, that was that it diverges and we had to do this thing here. But if you plug it here, so you have nabla theta goes like n phi over r. Of course, dl is proportional to phi hat. And then you have, well, r times dr. So really, this gives you, you know, 2 pi n. So the equation, that equation is satisfied. Okay? So do it yourself. Papa theta is that. You plug it here, and you verify that this equation is true. Okay? So now let's use this to calculate what the energy is. So what is the Hamiltonian? It's just, so the energy is just 1/2 from here, d square x, nabla theta square. Okay, so it's n square over r square. And I write this d square x in the polar coordinates. So you have r dr d phi, that's your d square x, and then you have n square over r square. Okay, so of course integral over 2 d phi gives you 2 pi. So I have 2 pi divided by 2, which is pi, and then n square, and then integral dr over r. Okay. So what are the limits of this integral? So of course, the upper limit is I go to the size of the system, which I'll call L. So I have a system which has the radius L, big L. So what is the lower bound? That's imposed by the validity of your continuum, of your continuous limit. So if you set small r equal to 0, you know that you are terribly wrong here because your nabla theta diverges, and so you are wrong here. So what you actually have to do is, you know, to think, well, this is the right picture. So I cannot go all the way, you know, to the position of my vortex, but I have to have some, you know, some distance away where this nabla theta is actually well defined, and, you know, it's reasonable. And so this thing will be approximately of the lattice spacing A. So the lower, so I have to exclude the vortex. I put the lower limit A here. I will exclude the core of the vortex. So I basically surround my vortex and I say I integrate, you know, from here to the size of the system, but I don't integrate here. But it's a finite region, and, you know, nothing blows up here because everything is regularized. So this gives some, you know, negligible finite contribution to the energy. But whatever, you know, okay, so that's a motivation. So of course, the integral 1 over r is a logarithm. So you get this is equal to pi. Pi n square logarithm of L over A. Okay, and so indeed, if the size of the system is infinite, L goes to infinity, and you get infinite energy contribution here. Everybody happy? Okay, so it costs infinite energy. Why can we have them? It's because you remember from your thermodynamics is that not always you want to minimize your energy. In fact, almost always you want to minimize the free energy. Okay, so to find whether the configuration is possible or not, you want to minimize the free energy. Actually, well, this is how much one vortex costs, but actually we want to minimize free energy. So F is E minus T times entropy. So we already calculated what E is to cost, you know, one vortex. So now what is the entropy? And so basically, if I want to create a vortex in my condensed matter system, the entropy is associated. So now I have a microstate, which has a macrostate, which has one vortex in it. But this vortex can be, you know, basically in any pocket of your system. And so the entropy associated with this vortex is really, you know, how many possibilities I have to displace this vortex through my system so that I have, in the end, one vortex. Okay, so this entropy thing, so S is something like logarithm of number of possibilities to place my vortex into my system. And so if I say that basically the vortex really takes, well, the placket is something like A square size, and so the possibilities is really the size of the system, well, divided by A square. Okay, so this is something like logarithm of L over A square, or 2 times logarithm L over A. So now you see that the entropy is also huge, right? It also diverges, because I have many possibilities to place the vortex there. And so if you want what your free energy is, you just plug these 2 things here. So F is E, which is pi n square, pi n square, and then the logarithm, and then minus t times the minus 2t, probably, 2t, logarithm L over A. Okay, so this is your free energy. So now you say a configuration, these are all the vortex, cause zero free energy. Configuration with the vortex cause this free energy. So whenever, well, your vortex configuration will be preferable if the free energy is actually negative. So F is smaller than zero means vortex is preferable. And of course, for that, you get that the temperature must be bigger than pi over 2. Okay, so that's vortex with binding number n, but the smallest possible n is n equal to 1. So if I take n equal to 1, then I can start having vortices, and for the temperature, which is bigger than Tk equal to pi over 2. So for temperatures bigger than that, suddenly the system can start having vortices. It's actually energetically or thermodynamically favorable to the vortices.
Okay. It's minus infinite. So it is not only preferable, it is...
Yeah, so you will have that. Yes. You will have that. Okay. So this thing here, the Tk, is called Kostelitz-Tawes temperature.
It's typically denoted as TKT.
Okay, TKT. Let me use that. So this TKT is Kostelitz Thomas temperature. And basically, as you cross the temperature, you go from, you know, no vortex to vortex phase transition. Okay. And so really this TKT is that critical temperature which I mentioned before. And so below that, so T is small TKT, you have no vortices. Xi is infinite. And so the correlation function goes like 1 over x to eta. For T bigger than TKT, you have vortices. And then Xi is finite. And so there's the connection is what happened before. Okay. Very good. So you can think about this Xi, the correlation length, as the mean distance between free vortices. So if you are below this TKT temperature, basically, you know, there is no vortices, or the distance between them is actually infinite. You don't have any free vortices. If you are above the temperature, then you have, you know, one vortex here, and the xi is basically how far is another one, and so on. Okay, so xi is basically like a distance between vortices. Distance between vortices. Very good. So, of course, this has nothing to do with the long-range order. It's a different type of phase transition. And because, you know, what you are really translating here, while creating here, is these topological objects. So this is called topological phase transition. So topological phase transition.
So it actually just acquired.
Yep.
So at low temperatures, there is no true long-range order, but quite often people talk about quasi-long-range order.
Okay. Yeah. Very nice. So now why I'm talking about this is, of course, there was a Nobel Prize awarded for this in 2016 Nobel Prize. So now we are completely up to date. and so this prize was awarded precisely to Kostelitz, Taules, and somebody else, with, by the way, associated with PI somehow. So that's the most important person. I never remember who it is. So you are most up to date. Of course, this calculation was done much earlier. It was done in the 70s, but finally the Nobel Prize was awarded. And of course, you know, Nobel Prize is not awarded only for theoretical results, but they have to be somehow backed with some experimental results. And basically, you know, you observe these type of phase transitions, for example, in helium-4, as you go from superfluid to normal phase thing. So really, you know, this has been observed, and so it's backed with the experiment, and so that's why it can obtain a Nobel Prize. So final remark, I want to say is that final remark is that, you know, the vortices actually, you know, not all the vortices are actually created exactly at this temperature TKT. In fact, the vortices are created much earlier, so even for temperatures smaller than that. So if T is equal to zero, there are no vortices at all. But if even at T smaller than TKT, can have vortices, can have some. But in some sense, they are not free vortices. They are bounded to live together. So they are bounded in dipoles and stuff like that. So in the form of vortex anti-vortex pairs. Okay. So what is a vortex anti-vortex pair? Well, it's of course I have, you know, something n equals to plus one and something n equals to minus one, and this thing, this guy, travels together as a dipole, if you want, or vortex dipole. And of course the total n, this is n equal to minus one, the total n of this thing is n equal to zero, and so it only affects spins, you know, in their vicinity. So these things actually cost much less energy, and the energy is proportional to, so the energy is proportional to logarithms of the distance, xi minus xj over a. Okay, so if the, you know, because they are very, very close to each other, well, this thing is much smaller than the size of the system. So if you had one vortex, the energy is proportional to L over A. Right, the size of the system over A, so it's huge energy to create three vortex. But if you want to create a vortex pair, then the energy is only proportional to their distance. Of course, if the distance is finite and small, then yeah, the energy is relatively small and you can create them. So this is basically how you start forming these vortices. You may think about it is that You know, as your temperature increases from zero, you start popping these vortices out, but they are, you know, they always form in pairs in some sense. So they form in pairs, and another forms here, another forms here, another forms there. As you keep increasing the temperature, you provide so much energy, or it's energetic favor, that actually they can, you know, start colliding with each other, and they can become free. And so this precisely happens at this TKT. Okay, so that's okay. So now I just wanted to show you something here. So can I get the screen, please? Thank you. And let's see if that works. Probably not.
Are cosmic strings associated with free vortices, or?
Well, it's like a topological defect on its own. I don't know if you can create a cosmic string like a pair of cosmic strings.
Yeah, I was thinking like a tube.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. Why this is not working?
Is the image on your computer?
Yes, it is. I'll try once more. Collapse of technology.
I don't see the image at all coming to me.
Yeah. So what should I do?
Just try reconnecting that connector again, pull it out and try it again.
Okay. Okay, so it doesn't work. We can try for 5 more minutes.
I still don't have it.
Okay, I'll try it once more. Okay, so you can probably do it yourself. So what I wanted to show you, so I found this very nice blog link by Baez, and so he's basically showing all these vortices. So he shows, you know, how the vortex look like and how the anti-vortex look like. So you can think about a vortex really something which you are familiar from your bathtub. So you can have a vortex is something which goes like spins goes around it. So which is of course slightly different to picture what I was drawing is that vortex is something which goes like that. But remember that you can actually rotate all your spins by arbitrary rotation. So if you rotate all the spins the same way, then actually the Hamiltonian is still, you know, invariant, and you can still describe everything like that. So in some sense I can make a perpendicular spin here, perpendicular spin here, perpendicular here, and here, and then you are getting to that picture. So basically, you can think about vortices as something which goes in this way. The anti-vortex, on the other hand, looks like something like this. So again, you can rotate everything by 90 degrees, and you are getting something interesting. But what vortex is always anti-vortex, so this is n equals to minus 1. And then this is n equals to plus 1. And so you can now connect these two together. And so there's this movie, and so click on that link which is in the study text. And so there's this movie how really you can pop out this vortex, anti-vortex pair from you know, ordered system of spins. So you have no ordered system of spins, and suddenly, you know, anti-vortex and vortex pops out, and then again splits. And then you see how all these spins around, you know, start you know, changing. And so if you have the vortex and anti-vortex pair very, very close to each other, it's only the nearby spins which are affected. But if you start separating them, it's more and more spins are involved. So it costs more and more energy. Okay? And so if you finally separate them completely, then, you know, it costs infinite energy to create each of them. And so you can run that video in that link, which is in the study text. Okay, so let me finish here.